Okay, great. So we're recording now. So why don't we just jump in and get started? The recording will also be available. We'll send around an email, or if anyone wants the recording, you can get in contact with me and I can make that available to you. And it will be available for anyone who did not was not able to get on the live call. Okay, let's jump in. So first of all, hello to everyone. Thanks for joining us. And we're doing a teleconference tonight on U.S. estate and income taxation. I have a lot of clients, well, all around the world, really, but there's some U.S. expats who are living outside the U.S. There's also plenty of non-U.S. people who have some kind of connection to the United States. And so this teleconference is going to be an overview of three or four of kind of the main topics that affect people who have a connection to the United States. So I'm going to start out with the basis for estate taxation in the United States, and there are four categories. And I always start with these four categories because I find that whenever you're dealing with someone with a U.S. connection, you first have to figure out which of these four categories they fall into, and then from that point on, it can be a lot easier to assess what their needs are, what potential taxation there is, what the rules are, all of that good stuff. So let's start with the four categories. The first is U.S. citizenship. So, and again, we're talking for estate tax purposes for this one. We'll talk about income tax in a second. But for estate tax purposes, and that is the tax on property that passes at death to beneficiaries, it also deals with the transfer of assets that occur during the lifetime of someone. So in the United States, the estate and gift tax is a unified tax system. So it's basically the
assets during the life of someone to their donee, and it is the same tax that is incurred when someone dies and then their assets pass on to the next, to their beneficiaries. Okay. And So the four bases for that is, number one is U.S. citizenship. So if anyone is a U.S. citizen, it does not matter where they are in the world or where their assets are in the world. If they are a U.S. citizen, they are subject to the U.S. federal estate and gift tax system. Okay? So some U.S. people are very unaware of this, and if they have left the physical borders of the United States and they are living elsewhere, and all of their assets are elsewhere outside the U.S., they may not have any income whatsoever in the U.S., but they're simply a U.S. citizen. There are a lot still of these individuals who do not realize they are subject to the estate and gift tax in the United States, and we'll learn in a minute how they're also subject to the income tax in the United States. They may not owe anything, but they're required to file returns and basically check in once a year with the Internal Revenue Service. Okay, so that's category one, U.S. citizenship. U.S. residency is the second category, and so that is someone, they are not a citizen, and yet they are deemed a resident of the United States. For estate and gift tax purposes, the definition of a resident is a very non-quantifiable definition. And so what it means is, the short definition is, if someone has an intention to remain indefinitely in the United States, then they are considered a U.S. resident for estate and gift tax purposes. Okay? So this is not counting any kind of days. It is not, are you, you know, physically within the borders? It's not a kind of quantifiable test. It is one of intention, and that intention is formed in the brain of an individual, which, as you might imagine, might be a gray area and not always easy to determine if someone is a resident or not. So a lot of practice with some clients can be determining if they are, in fact, a U.S. resident or not. So we'll talk about what that looks like, what the test is for that. But for now, that's category two. So first category, U.S. citizen. Second category, U.S. resident, someone who has an intention of remaining where they are. Number three is U.S. itis property. So if someone is not a citizen, they don't fit the definition under number one. They are not a U.S. resident. They don't fit the definition under number two. But they own U.S. itis property. So they own property that is physically located in the United States. For estate and gift tax purposes, U.S. itis property is going to be real estate or immovable property. It's going to be a house, you know, a building, land, that kind of thing. And the second is going to be tangible personal property, meaning stuff, you know, the painting, the jewelry, something in a safe deposit box somewhere. That's going to be considered U.S. itis property. That's category three. So not a citizen, not a resident, but they have U.S. itis property, property that is physically located within U.S. borders. The fourth category is expatriates and former U.S. residents who have left the United States after June 16th of 2008. That may seem like a little bit of a random date, but that is the law that is in place right now for people who have left the U.S. So the U.S. does this funny thing, and if citizens give up citizenship or if residents give up residency, the United States has a rule that basically still seeks to govern those individuals under certain circumstances, and we're going to talk about what those circumstances look like, okay? But that's our overview of estate and gift. Those are the four categories: citizenship, residency, U.S. itis property, and expatriates and the former U.S. residents, okay? What does all that mean? How are they taxed? U.S. citizens are taxed for estate and gift tax purposes on their gross estate wherever situated, okay? So it's everything they own in the entire world, okay? U.S. is a little bit unique in that we love to tax way beyond our borders. We just go right through those borders, and if someone's a citizen, we follow them around the globe, and we still tax them. Category two, U.S. residents, same rules. Wherever a U.S. resident is or wherever that person's assets are, they are taxed on their gross estate wherever situated in the world. Same rule. Category three, U.S. itis property. Those are not citizens, not residents, but these are the people who own U.S. itis property. Only the U.S. itis property is subject to estate or gift taxation in the United States. Okay? And then finally, the former citizens, the expatriates, the former U.S. residents, if they have left after June 16, 2008, and they are subject to the current law, which is in place, law has changed every 10 years or so lately, but this is the current law we have in place, and right now the former laws that were in place have expired as far as if someone has expatriated prior to 2008, the laws that were in place at that time have expired, and so they are not applicable to anyone at this point. So it's just this most current law that would apply to people who have given up the citizenship or given up the residency, okay? And we'll talk a little bit later about exactly what the taxation is for those folks. Okay, there is a federal estate tax exemption amount. In 2019, it's $11.4 million, and so that applies to U.S. citizens and U.S. residents. Even though the gross estate is included, wherever it's situated in the world, the entire amount, there's also right now a pretty historically high exemption amount where the first $11.4 million for anyone passing away in 2019 or gifting in 2019 is exempt from the tax. So the tax only begins after $11.4 million. Okay, the rule is different for those Category 3 people, the people who are not citizens, not residents, but they own U.S. itis property. Those people only have a $60,000 exemption amount. That $60,000 exemption amount has been in place in the law for at least 45 years. It has not changed one bit. It is not indexed for inflation like the other exemption amounts are. It has stayed the same. It has not changed one bit. And politicians here in the U.S. don't like to talk about changing this particular one either. It is not clear why it has never changed. It is an incredibly small number. And so what happens is we need to be aware that when purchasing property in the United States and coming under the estate and gift taxation laws here in the United States, that whatever is purchased is essentially, it's safe to say that essentially the entire amount is subject to estate and gift tax because there's only a $60,000 exemption amount. So 45 years ago, that number may have been a little bit larger, but nowadays it doesn't get you very far at all. And so there's, you know, a minimal exemption amount. So plenty of planning to be done for non-resident aliens who purchase something or, you know, establish some kind of U.S.-itis property before they do that, which is always difficult with clients, is to try to convince them to do something prior to actually doing it. Okay. Let's talk about U.S. residency and what that definition looks like. I'm going to pause for a second. I'm just going to check my emails if anyone has sent me questions. Does anyone have questions on the phone? And you can just unmute your line and ask the question. Okay. All right. I don't think
I have one, actually.
Okay. Yeah. Oh, go ahead.
Yeah, it's Andre from Singapore. Can you elaborate more about U.S. bank accounts? I think the threshold is also $60,000, but it depends what you have on the bank account. So I think it covers mostly U.S. Stocks. What about non-U.S. stocks deposited with U.S. banks? Is it covered by the $60,000 U.S. dollar threshold, or is it out, basically out of these thresholds?
Okay, so in answer to that, the $60,000 exemption amount is just for U.S. situs property, and so a bank account in the U.S. would not be considered U.S. situs property. A U.S. situs property would include real estate or tangible personal property. It is something that's physically located within our borders, but bank accounts are considered intangible property, and so they are not subject to the estate tax if the account holder passes away. Now, they're subject to a whole lot of reporting requirements, which we'll talk about later in the teleconference, but they would not be subject, at the death of that bank account holder, they would not be subject to federal estate tax here in the U.S.
So having, I think there is a slight difference between U.S. banks accounts and U.S. broker accounts. But you confirm that having U.S. stocks on a U.S. bank account is basically outside the rule, right?
Right.
It's not
so
covered by
it's not subject to U.S. property at death is stock in a U.S. corporation. Which is perhaps what you're referring to. So the rules are a little bit different. For estate tax purposes, stock in a U.S. corporation is considered U.S. status property. So if someone owns 100 shares of Disney Corporation and they pass away wherever in the world, those shares of Disney are considered U.S. status property and will be subject to estate tax and the $60,000 exemption amount. If instead during that person's lifetime they decide to gift their shares of Disney, it is not subject to gift tax. So this is one strange difference between the estate and gift tax, even though it is a unified system and they're considered essentially the same tax to be used during life or at death. A distinction is made And it may just be a blip in the tax code. You know, may have just been kind of a loophole that somehow it fell through. But if the holder of the shares of Disney gifts them away during life, that is not considered U.S. by this property for gift tax purposes, and so they're free to go ahead and transfer those things. And yet, if they hold on to them and they pass away with them at the time of their death, it is subject to the estate tax in the U.S. Does that answer your question?
Yeah. Thanks.
Okay, great. All right, so let's talk about residency. I mentioned how residency for estate and gift tax purposes is one of intention, that people who are considered domiciled in the U.S. are those who live in the U.S. with no definite present intention of leaving. So it is a intention rather than a black and white quantifiable kind of a test. So what do we do to look? I mean, some of the planning that we do with clients is to say, should you be resident here? Should you not be resident here? And there's no set rule. You know, I've heard some clients say, well, I've been told that I should never be a resident of the U.S., or I've been told that I should always be a resident of the U.S. And it just really depends on every individual situation. I wish it was that easy, but it isn't. It depends on the other countries in which that person is affiliated. It depends the level of assets. It depends the level of the federal estate tax exemption amount that is in place. So all of these things are the moving parts that can change. And so whether someone is being more tax efficient by being resident in the U.S. or by not being resident in the U.S. totally depends on the person. But let's take a look at what factors are looked at to determine if someone has established residency in the U.S. Have they established that intention? Have they evidenced their intention that they are going to stay here and that they have no intention of leaving? So the law is going to look at where they own real estate. Where do they own their home? If they have more than one home, is one bigger than the other? Does one home seem more like a pied-à-terre and one seems more like a primary residence? Does one home seem more like a vacation home, or perhaps the other one seems more like a primary residence? Where are their personal ties? Where does the rest of their immediate family live? It is not necessarily determinative. There are cases that have been decided where spouses live in two different countries, and that is not the only factor that determines whether they're considered resident or not. You know, so in other words, spouses can actually have separate residences, and the residences are actually honored. The law also takes a look at what does someone's passport say about them. Where do they file their tax returns? What address do they put on their tax returns? What do their legal documents say? So if they have a will, a trust, a power of attorney, a medical power of attorney, those kinds of things. When it lists their name, what does it say after their name as far as where they live or where they reside? And so all of these things are looked at together, and they're kind of weighed. It's the totality of the circumstances test, where the court will look at all of those things and say, I'm feeling more like this person is resident, or I'm feeling more like this person is not a resident. And so there's a fair number of cases that go through and make that analysis. And so that gives us a general idea of where, you know, where the court may come out with a particular client. So that's residency for estate and gift. Okay. Let's go on to income taxation. So any more questions on estate taxation? I will check my email again. Okay. All right. Let's talk about the rules for income taxation now. So our categories, there were four categories for estate and gift. There are three for income taxation, and they're going to sound very, very similar. The first category is U.S. citizenship. If someone is a U.S. citizen, wherever they reside, wherever in the world they reside, and wherever in the world their income is generated from, it really doesn't matter because the citizenship controls. And so anyone with U.S. citizenship is considered a U.S. income tax resident. And so what does that mean? It means they must file a tax return each year with the IRS. So again, even that person who has never lived here, you know, some people are U.S. citizens because of birth or through parents or something like that, and they've never actually, you know, formed any real personal ties to the country. Perhaps they've lived almost their entire life somewhere else, and perhaps they've always, their assets and their income are all, you know, from a non-U.S. source, and yet they have U.S. citizenship. They are taxed on their worldwide income wherever they are located. Now, because there's so many income tax treaties with the U.S. and just about every other country, there's almost 200 income tax treaties out there, it doesn't necessarily mean they're going to owe any tax, but they are required to file the return. So what they may be doing, you know, for many people, is that they're going to be filing a return wherever they live, wherever their country, in whatever country they are domiciled, and then they are also going to be filing a U.S. income tax return, that's a resident return, and it is going to claim a treaty provision with that other country, and it's going to say, yes, here's all my information. Here's perhaps the tax that would have been due, but for Article 5 in the income tax treaty, which basically says the other country gets the tax at all. Sometimes that happens, sometimes it doesn't. So, for instance, I just had a client recently who is a U.S. citizen by birth but has never actually lived here, has no connection to the U.S. We are getting her compliant with the IRS. Because she should have been filing tax returns all along, but never did, like a lot of U.S. citizens have not. And so we're putting this all together, and in doing so, she has to file 3 past years of income tax returns. In doing that, she has realized that her home country, you know, the country in which she lives, does not tax capital gain, and yet the U.S. does tax capital gain. And so while she sold some real estate in her home country that is not subject to capital gain, it is subject to capital gain in the United States. And so she will actually owe the U.S. simply because the differences in the income tax laws between the two countries is different enough that she does owe one of the country's tax and the other country does not have a comparable tax. And the income tax treaty between those two countries does not address that. Okay? So for many people, even though they're U.S. citizens, and yes, they need to file a return, they still don't owe anything. And that's fairly common. And yet, once in a while, you're going to get a particular situation where, unfortunately, they do still owe something in the United States because of that. Okay, so that's Category 1, U.S. citizenship. Sounds like a similar rule to the estate tax in that tax on worldwide income wherever that individual is located. Okay. Category 2, U.S. residency. Same category as the estate category. A U.S. resident, for income tax purposes, is also taxed on worldwide income wherever that individual is located. However, how someone is determined to be a U.S. resident for income tax purposes is pretty different from the way it's determined for estate tax purposes. And we'll talk about that in a second. And finally, our third category, there's only 3 for income tax, is non-U.S. residents. What are they taxed on? They're taxed on their U.S. source income. So again, these categories are analogous to the ones under estate tax. They're applied in a seemingly similar way. But the U.S. residency definitions are quite different. So how is someone determined to be a resident for income tax purposes in the United States? So there's basically 2 tests and then an exception, because we always have to have exceptions to our laws. The first test is the person a lawful permanent resident? And that is defined as anyone with a green card. So that is someone who has been recognized and enabled to be resident in the United States for immigration purposes. We call it the green card. So they've applied and they have been granted a green card to work here in the United States. Okay. So people who have that are automatically considered resident for income tax purposes. Again, doesn't always mean that they're going to owe income tax, but it means that they have to file the return. They've got to do the math. They've got to maybe claim any treaty provisions, you know, whatever they're doing with other countries that require them to report for income tax purposes, and then they figure if they owe anything. All right. That's lawful permanent resident. So if someone has a green card, they are resident for income tax purposes. So that's a pretty black and white test, right? Not like a state tax. It's pretty clear. You either have a green card or you don't. Okay, second category is substantial presence test. So this is where you have to be physically present under a certain formula in order to be considered an income tax resident. What is that formula? So it is one-third of the days you were physically present in the last year, plus one-sixth of the days in the year prior to that, plus a total number of days in the current year. If you add, so you're looking back 3 years, in the current year, you count up all the days that you're physically present in the United States, you look to the year prior to that, and you take one-third of those days, and then you look at the year prior to that year, and you add up the days, and you take one-sixth of those days, which is physically present. You add those things up. If you reach 183 days, then you are a U.S. resident. If you are under 183 days, you are not a U.S. resident. Okay, that's called the substantial presence test. It means that you've physically been within U.S. borders for a minimum amount of time over a three-year period. Okay? So it's a formula. You add it up. You either here or you want. Pretty black and white. Okay. There is an exception. There's something called the closer connection test. It means that if you've actually been here less than 183 days and your tax home and center of vital interest are in another country and you can argue that, then you may be granted non-residency under the closer connection test, basically saying I'm closer connected to a different country other than the U.S., here's why, and that's a little bit more of a gray area. So that sort of turns into a state tax test, you know, of residency, where it's like, well, it's not a black and white test. It's not like we're counting days, but we're going to take a look at, you know, how do I operate? How am I connected to this country? And, you know, and so a taxpayer can make that argument. The IRS does not have to agree with it, and you can continue to fight it out if you want to. Okay. But the two big tests are the lawful permanent resident test, the green card test, and two, the substantial presence test, and that's for income tax purposes. Okay? So that's an overview of that. Any questions on income tax? Okay. All right. Let's jump forward and talk a little bit about our compliance requirements. So in the past decade, it has been a decade because it's 2019, certainly in the U.S. and in many other countries, U.S. people who have had bank accounts or assets in other countries, in non-U.S. countries, they have certain reporting requirements. And what really happened prior to 2009 is that very few of those reporting requirements were actually enforced by the U.S. And in about 2004, the enforcement of these various requirements was actually handed over to the IRS. It didn't used to be the IRS's responsibility, the Internal Revenue Service, the tax collectors. It didn't used to be their responsibility to enforce these compliance requirements. It was actually banking laws that required most of these reporting things, and very little enforcement was going on. And so the enforcement was handed over in 2004, and over the next 5 years, there were rumors that enforcement was going to begin. In 2009, the IRS came out kind of with a very, very dramatic announcement that anyone who had not been adhering to these enforcement requirements were going to be penalized. However, they then offered an amnesty program. And so foreign account compliance, as we call it here in the U.S., became a very big deal, and it's still a fairly big deal, and it is around the world, and I know that as well. And here in the U.S., people have since sat up and taken a lot of notice on exactly if they have a non-U.S. connection of any kind, they have taken a look at exactly what they need to be filing in the U.S. each year. And so a lot has changed since 2009 when this came out. So I'm going to do an overview. There are many, many things that are required, but I'm going to take kind of the most popular ones. So the first one that really kind of started all of the drama in 2009 was casually referred to as the FBAR. It was the Report of Foreign Bank and Financial Accounts, and it was a form. Now the form is called FinCEN 114. They've decided that they changed the name a couple of times on this form. And what it says is that if you have bank accounts in non-U.S. banks, and that means whether it's a U.S. branch somewhere, but literally if you have a bank account outside the U.S., then you have to report that. And there has to be a minimum amount in there. If you have $10,000 or above, then you've got to report. If you have really small bank accounts and the aggregate value of them outside the U.S. is below the $10,000, then you don't need to be filing these forms, okay? But $10,000 and above, and this is the aggregate, add them all up, and if it's at least $10,000, then the FinCEN 114 has to be filed each year. The penalties for not filing that form, and it truly is a form. There's nothing to do with it. It's just a report. It's a list of any bank accounts outside the United States. And if that form is not filed, the penalties that were in the law were huge. And basically what they said was, we can take, for each year that that form is not filed, we can take 50% of the value of the account, not the tax due, not the the actual account itself, and that they could do that for each year that it wasn't filed. And what that meant is that, someone could not only lose all of the assets in the account, but they could then continue to have to owe simply because of the penalty. So it was a very the other part of that penalty was it was actually the greater of 50% of the balance of the account or $100,000, whichever is greater. So if you had $12,000 in an account that was not reported and the IRS felt that you did that willfully, that you did that on purpose, they could actually penalize you $100,000 for an account that only had $12,000 in it. So the penalties were a little bizarre. There is a non-willful versus willful distinction, however, in these kinds of penalties. And so if the form was not filed non-willfully, which, of course, for many, many people, it was non-willful, then you could have a maximum of a $10,000 penalty and a penalty that is as low as $0, okay? And so for a lot of people outside of this latest decade of foreign account compliance, The non-willful penalty applied. People weren't so worried about it. They simply filed the form with a reasonable cause statement saying, you know, oops, I forgot, or I had no idea, or I went to an accountant and my accountant didn't say anything to me, whatever. And normally that would be okay. But over the last 10 years, there was really kind of a view from the U.S. government that anyone who didn't file that form must have done so willfully. And so they were talking about these very large, scary penalties. To what end? To what end is that a lot of people who had not been filing because this enforcement had not really ever been happening, and all of a sudden, you know, it was enforced with a huge penalty attached, is that a lot of people went into this amnesty program and they started filing everything with the IRS and paying, you know, the amnesty penalty, which when it started in 2009 was something like 20% of the value of the account, I believe it was, in 2009, which seemed a lot lower than a possible 50% value of the account for every single year that the form wasn't filed. So it was a little bit of a difficult time when people were trying to figure out what to do. Where are we with all of that? Because the approach from the U.S. government has changed as the years have gone by. 2009 had one program that lasted, that was a flat 20% penalty, and that lasted through, it was announced in March of 2009, and it went through the end of September. No, I think it actually went through October of the same year. They kind of opened the period, accepted all kinds of filings from people to get caught up, collected a lot of dollars, and then closed the period in October. Another please be quiet for a little while. In 2011, another program was introduced, and that lasted. When did they introduce that? That lasted through September of 2011. And then the penalties went up a little bit. For that, the amnesty amount was 25% of the value of the account. They closed that program in 2011. They came up with another program, and actually, it was open for several years. It didn't have a closing date at first, but it actually just recently closed on September 28th of 2018. So less than a year ago. That closed. And there is another program that is still in effect that we are still working with people to get them compliant with the IRS, and that's called the Streamlined Program. This is one, for U.S. people, there's a 5% penalty on the value of those accounts, a whole lot better than the 20, 25, and 27.5% from before. Penalty is only 5%. And for some people living outside the U.S., there is no penalty. And so what that program asks people to do is to go back a few years, file the U.S. tax returns that they were supposed to file, pay any U.S. tax that they were supposed to pay that may have been generated by those returns in those tax years, and then for people in the U.S. to then pay an additional penalty of 5% of the highest year's account or assets. Here, too, this program expanded a little bit from just bank accounts, and it can actually expand to some assets that are for investment in other countries. So they've tweaked the program a little bit. The Streamlined Program was really in response to so many practitioners, myself included, that said to the IRS, you know, your program is really flawed because it treats everyone as if they did all of this willfully. And so many people didn't. Some did, I mean, absolutely, but many people did not. They just did not understand what the requirements were. And a lot of people had professional advisors as well and just, you know, had not, you know, like I said, all of these forms that should have been filed generally were not being filed prior to these things happening. So we have a Streamlined Program. It goes back 3 years for taxes. It goes back 6 years for the reporting forms. And then the taxpayer also has to write up a non-willful statement. They really have to go through the history and explain why things were not filed when they should have been filed. It is possible that the IRS will not accept that statement or not believe it or say, we actually do think that this is willful. Knock on wood, I have not had that happen with anyone yet. But that is the program that's in place now. And there's no deadline that right now has been announced for this program. So it's still a good option for people who are aware of this issue out there, who have, you know, some connection to the U.S. where they should have filed returns and perhaps may owe some tax, or didn't file the reporting forms and they want to do that. This program is still available. It's still open, and the penalty is not scary. It's not. So, any questions on foreign account compliance before we move on? And let me check. I think I have a see if I have any. Question. Okay, no email questions. Any questions on the phone on the foreign account compliance issue? Okay. All right. So I just want to go into the next topic, which is, it's really two topics. It's pre-immigration planning and expatriation. What that means is, before someone establishes ties with the U.S., what kind of opportunities are there? And then expatriation, what happens when someone gives up that U.S. citizenship or the U.S. residency? What happens to them there? Pre-immigration is fairly straightforward, I guess. And it can also be more difficult because, again, whenever you're dealing with clients, you would love it if they call you before they go ahead with all kinds of plans. And the reality is that that's not the reality. And what normally happens is clients go ahead and they do what they want, and then they call you and they say, I just did this, this, and this. Was that okay? And by that time, planning opportunities have perhaps disappeared. So that's what pre-immigration planning is. It's a wonderful thing if you can work with the client before they immigrate or before they establish ties with the U.S., which is why I love to speak to immigration attorneys and other advisors, because they tend to be the ones on the front line flagging this issue for their clients when they come in saying, I'm thinking about doing this, that, or the other in the United States. And so it can be very, very helpful for an advisor to say, okay, before you do that, let's take a look at what does your estate look like? What do your assets look like? Do we need to perhaps do some pre-immigration planning before you actually establish those ties with the U.S.? If you can get someone that far ahead of time, it's kind of amazing what you can do for them. but again, a lot of that depends on the client. If we go back to the first topic that we talked about, we took a look at estate tax in the U.S., and we had four categories of people. So we talked about when people are citizens, when people are residents. Then we also talked about people who are neither of those things, but they own U.S. situs property. And basically, if someone is not a citizen or a resident of the United States, they are, but for their U.S. situs property, they are outside of the estate and gift taxation system, okay? Because there is no, if they don't have the U.S. situs property, there is no basis, there is no jurisdiction on which the IRS can tax them. Okay, so that's an opportunity. That's an opportunity for someone who in the future is going to establish ties with the U.S. and may perhaps be considered U.S. resident for estate tax purposes. Or maybe they absolutely are going ahead and saying, first I want to get a green card and then I intend on becoming a citizen at some point. So if someone has plans like that, then we want to take care of as much transferring as possible before they actually find themselves in category one or two, resident or citizen, because there is no 11.4 million exemption amount for them. There is no 60,000 exemption amount because they have no USITIS property. They essentially are free of the taxation system in the U.S. So what do we do with clients like that? We take a look at what their future plans may be. Some of them, for instance, they have children or grandchildren who have established themselves in the U.S., and so they see themselves into the future, and they say that they will probably, toward the end of their life, wind up where the rest of their family is. And so they're looking at the U.S. and saying, yes, I think it's entirely possible that we will wind up there and establishing domicile there. And so if that's the case, we work with them to transfer assets that they're able to transfer prior to them establishing those ties, setting up a U.S. trust in the United States, funding the trust there, and the amount from a U.S. perspective, any amount can be transferred in, stored in the trust, beneficiaries are named. It doesn't matter where the beneficiaries are, but again, if there's, for instance, children, grandchildren, other ties are already established in the U.S., much easier for a U.S. person to be a beneficiary of a U.S. trust. There's not a lot of complication there. And so that's an opportunity there where that person has already essentially made the transfer to ultimate beneficiaries without incurring any of the estate or gift taxation limits or taxes that the U.S. imposes. What this does not do is we don't know what the non-U.S. country says about all of that. If the country where the person is coming from or the country where that person has citizenship, we also would have to look at those rules and ask advisors in those jurisdictions to say, what are the rules there for transferring assets? So it may be a very good situation, but if the country of origin also has an estate tax or a gift tax and is going to tax them on the transfer of those assets, then maybe it isn't the best situation. Again, we don't know until we know exactly, what the laws of the other country are. Okay, so that's just a brief overview on pre-residency planning or pre-immigration planning. That's the opportunity. And that's really, advisors are the ones that really come into that, who can help a client plan for that. We are almost out of time. Our last topic is going to be expatriation. Before I start on that, does anyone have any questions on pre-immigration planning or anything else that we talked about tonight? And then I'll jump into expatriation. Okay. Final topic is expatriation. So someone has ties to the U.S., they're either a citizen, perhaps they're a resident, they have a green card, and now they're looking at giving that up. And why would they do that? Well, because of everything we just talked about, the U.S. loves to tax people who aren't here, who aren't in the U.S. anymore and perhaps haven't been in the U.S. And so many of them have kind of gotten in trouble in recent years because they didn't realize that they were supposed to file things and report things, and perhaps they wrote out some very large checks to the IRS to kind of come into compliance about all of that. And during that process, a lot of people thought to themselves, probably, maybe I should just sever my ties to the U.S. because this has not been a fun experience. So a lot of people, especially with this with all the foreign account issues, they have said, I don't know, I've been walking around the world with this U.S. citizenship. What does it really do for me? It has given me a big headache in the last decade, and maybe I should just give it up. Not a lot of people like to do that. When they have U.S. citizenship, they do tend to hang on to it. We do not have a lot of emigration from the U.S. It's very, very low immigration country. However, what happens if someone decides to do that? So this would be, one, if someone is giving up a green card, second, if they're giving up citizenship. So those are the two categories that if you're giving those up, then an expatriation has occurred. If someone has a visa, for instance, in the U.S., they can give up a visa. That is not an expatriation. Okay, the immigration status has to be the green card or the lawful permanent resident. Okay, the U.S. wants to have an exit tax be triggered, but only for if the expatriate fits a certain profile. Okay. And the profile, in general, is someone who has a fair amount of access. This is going to be a wealthy person. And there's a net worth test that they have to meet first in order to worry about this exit tax. And it's this. Number one, they either have to have an estate of over $2 million, so they add up all their assets in the world, and the minimum amount has to be $2 million. Or they have an annual net income tax of over $168,000. That may seem like a random number. That is the number for 2019. So if someone is expatriating in 2019, they have to have an annual net income tax, not an annual net income. This means that their tax bill is $168,000 or greater. And it has to be that number for the 5 years preceding the loss of the citizenship or the residency. And we're talking about either very high income earners or someone with an estate of $2 million. Someone could have no income, but if they have worldwide assets of $2 million, then they would meet the net worth test. They would be subject to exit tax. Okay? So, in other words, if someone has $500,000 of a total net worth, and they have an annual income of $100,000, they can go ahead and expatriate. They're not going to be subject to the exit tax because they don't meet the net worth test. What is, for instance, when we work with a lot of highly compensated executives and that kind of thing, and they're here on a green card, and they're here for a particular assignment that's maybe 5 years or 8 years, they've spent a fair number of years here. And they are wondering to themselves, if I give up the green card, what is going to happen? So for lawful permanent residents, there's a few more tests to meet. And one of those tests is that they have to have that green card for 8 out of the previous 15 years. So again, even if someone meets that net worth test, they've got a very high income or they have at least $2 million in assets, and they have their green card, but they only have the green card for 6 years. They can go ahead and give up that green card, and they're not going to be subject to the exit tax. So what happens a lot is that when people are in year 6 or 7 of holding their green card, they begin to look around and say to themselves, do I need to keep the green card? Can I change my immigration status from green card to visa? And I have worked with clients to do that. Had them work with an immigration attorney, but part of their escape plan in the U.S. is to change their immigration status here. And so they go from green card to visa before they hit that 8 years of holding the green card, and then they can still continue on. Their immigration status is no longer green card, it's visa, and they can give up the visa, and they are not triggering that exit tax. Okay? Okay, so some of these are, the test is if this, not that, if something else, not the other. You kind of have to go through the test to see if someone really is going to be subject to it. There are also a couple of exceptions. If someone is a U.S. citizen by birth only, and they've always also been a citizen of another country, then there's an exception there. There may be an exception there. The other thing is for younger people, if someone is looking to relinquish the citizenship prior to reaching age 18 and a half, then there's an exception there as well. And I won't get into the details of those, but just sort of know that they're out there as well. And if you think about it, it's for children, essentially, someone under the age of 18 and a half who, they have no control over whether they're a citizen or not, and so they can kind of undo wherever they have been, born or carted around the world, because they're not an adult. Okay, so if someone is subject to the exit tax, what does that exit tax look like? It is a trigger of capital gain, worldwide capital gain. Okay, there is an exclusion amount to that. So again, in the U.S.'s way, the way it loves to look around the entire world and tax on the entire world, basically what they're saying is this. The exit tax is if you take all the capital assets that you have around the world and you take a look at your basis in those, what was the cost that they were acquired at, and now what is the value, that the day that you were considered to expatriate, on that day, what is the value of all of those assets and what is all the capital gain? All that built-in growth, that, and any amount over $713,000, that was the number in 2018, that number is also indexed for inflation, so it changes a little bit each year, but it's around $700,000 of gain. If you have under that amount, then you're still going to be doing your filings, but you're not going to have to pay anything. But if you're over that amount, then you will actually have to pay the tax on the capital gain to the United States worldwide. Okay, so that's the exit tax. There are some other elements to this law, which I'm not going to get into those details. But that's really kind of the main thing. There are some special rules for special items if you have deferred compensation items, if you have certain kinds of trusts, they're treated in a slightly different way. I'm not going to go into all that, but just the general exit tax is, it is a trigger of the worldwide capital gain and the taxes on that gain with an exclusion amount of $713,000. Okay? Okay, we are 1 minute before time, so I don't want to go over time. I want to pause for a second and see. We don't have any email questions coming in. Does anyone have any questions on the expatriation piece that we can cover before we wrap up? Okay. All right. I'm not hearing questions. So anyone who has participated, if you would like the audio recording of this, I can send that out so that you can go through and review again. I do have other resources on my website, paulajoneslaw.com. There's 4 or 5 minute audio PowerPoints on there on different topics. So feel free to just go to that website and you can take a look at anything. I can be reached at paula@paulajoneslaw.com. My contact is information there. If anyone has questions, follow up, anything like that, I'm happy to speak with anyone. Thank you, everyone, for joining. I really appreciate it, and I hope everyone has a great day.
Thank you.